from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with Jim May, the new executive director of the Hoosier Salon.
And in anticipation of the release of the movie Paper Towns, we'll replay an interview from a few years back that I did with author John Green.
And I'll talk with the author of a new book about black women in America, The Sisters Are All Right. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Hoosier Salon started life as a point of pride for some Indiana residents who moved out of state but wanted to showcase the merit of painters from their Hoosier home. Nearly a century later, this vibrant nonprofit continues to celebrate Indiana's artistic heritage and showcase its new artists as well. Sharon Gamble invited the Hoosier Salon's new executive director, Jim May, to talk with her about his new responsibilities and what he sees for the future of the organization.
So, remind us about your past careers. I know you've dealt with visual art before in the past.
Yeah, most of my career has been in the arts, mostly with museums. I was with the Indiana State Museum for quite a long time, sort of moving myself through that institution, starting off as curator, leaving as vice president of programming.
What was your primary interest as far as objects there?
I dealt with the fine art collection, so I had responsibility over the Hoosier Group paintings and the entire art collection.
Oh, my gosh. So it's like coming home to be at Hoosier Salon.
Yeah, that was kind of my point. I left the arts administration world for the private sector for about 5.5 years and really wanted to return to the arts.
Yeah. Remind us of the history. The Hoosier Salon's been around for kind of a long time.
This is the 91st year.
Wow.
It started by a group of women in Chicago called the Daughters of Indiana, who were exceptionally proud of their state and of the artists who were working in the state at that time, which was the 1920s. And the names most people are familiar with, T.C. Steele and William Forsythe, J. Otis Adams, that group, the Hoosier Group.
The Hoosier Group, yeah.
So they wanted to show them off, and they did an exhibition in Chicago at Marshall Fields and
really?
Started – and from that point on to today, this is our 91st year of having that same annual exhibition, the longest running art show in Indiana and perhaps, you know, part of the country. I've never actually done the math for the whole country, but definitely in the state of Indiana, it's the longest running continuous art exhibition.
And your annual exhibition is coming up very shortly.
It opens up July the 30th. We are now at the Indiana Historical Society at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick History Center. The show runs from July the 30th through September the 26th. We do have a preview reception and an awards event on the night of July the 29th. You can find out information about that on our website if you'd like to come and see who won what.
Sure. And so tell us how this works. Is there a membership for the Hoosier Salon? As an artist, do I need to be a member to be exhibited by you or considered for exhibition by you?
Well, you can support us in many, many ways. We have artist membership, which is the traditional base of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
To be an artist member, you can just pay your membership fee annually. To be in the annual exhibit, you have to have lived in Indiana for at least 1 year in your life. So you could have been born here and left at a very young age. You could have come here for school for a while and lived in the state or just had some affiliation with Indiana. But we have members who live in all parts of the country at the moment and work in all parts of the country. But the primary reason we exist is to support the artists who choose to live here and who want to be professional and practice their trade in Indiana.
And we have a surprisingly vibrant culture of visual artists here.
Yes, we certainly do. All kinds of media, all kinds of subject matter, all kinds of attitudes and perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, and it's everything. The continuation of the plein air tradition is still very, very strong in Indiana. There are a large number of artists who still choose to go out with oil and canvas and paint in the sunshine or in the rain, depending on the day.
This summer it would be in the rain, huh?
Right. But then you also have artists who are working in media that would not have been around 91 years ago, you know, video artists and you know, installation artists and conceptual artists, all sorts of stuff. And particularly a lot of those people are affiliated with the universities around the state.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my challenges or my charges is to make sure that the Hoosier Salon expands and grows to embrace everyone who calls them him or herself a visual artist.
Hmm. So when it started, the expatriate ladies in Chicago who were proud of their Hoosier home state and obviously proud of these remarkable artists who are part of the Hoosier group, when it started, it was a little bit about saying, hey, everybody who thinks about Midwest and art probably thinks about Chicago, but there's a great happening scene in Indiana, in Richmond, in Brown County, and beyond. Is the Hoosier Salon still... Does it still have as part of its mission or vision to export that image, the idea of the vitality of the art here?
Yes. The concept of promoting Indiana visual art and visual artists is an important part of what we want to do and what we strive to do. In today's world, it's a little different. Back in, you know, turn of the 20th century in 1920, you know, Indiana was still considered the West to a certain degree. The Society of Western Artists included Indiana.
That's right. That's right.
Today, you've got artists who, through social media and their websites, are selling all over the world, no matter where they're located. But there still are some biases or some opinions that the coasts have the scene or Chicago has the scene. And it's important that we challenge that wherever possible and find ways to push, you know, artists who are doing work here and showing work here up to the forefront of everybody's attention.
Well, I think when most people hear Hoosier Salon, they think paintings. But I feel like I've seen some 3D objects, some sculpture at Hoosier Salon.
You have, and not as much as I would like to see.
Okay.
I think that's one of the other components. In addition to the one annual exhibition we do have two galleries, one in Carmel and one in New Harmony, Indiana. And those galleries do... partially thematic shows where we promote different subject matter. We curate those exhibitions, but we also have a consignment gallery. And while most people will expect to come in and see watercolor and oil paintings, which we certainly have a lot of, I'm trying to find as many ways as possible to expand into glass and ceramic and sculpture of various kinds, and also include those more in, if not the actual annual exhibit that we currently are doing. Hopefully at some point we'll expand into doing perhaps two or three annual exhibitions on different different styles and different subject matter.
Awesome. The Carmel location is only a year old?
Right,
not
year.
Even,
just
right?
It's just probably right now it's just at a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Describe where that is and what that space is like.
It's in the Carmel Arts and Design District, downtown Carmel. The heart of it, probably you could consider the cross of Main Street and Rangeline Road. We're on 22 North Rangeline Road, just half a block north of Main Street. Lots of commercial galleries there, lots of restaurants, lots of shops. We, I believe, are the only not-for-profit entity in that mix.
Sweet.
Which is good for us to be there. I think that's one of the reasons we were attracted to going there, and also why I think Karma was attracted to having us there, is to add some different component. And hopefully, I don't really see the Hoosier Salon necessarily as a competitor with the commercial galleries. I think what our job is to make sure that we're endorsing the artists who are our members and really finding ways to service them and give them opportunities to educate themselves and really sort of understand how to do whatever they need to do to be successful. And in some ways, you know, for instance, we might want to do a show on, you know, who we consider to be the top 3 or 5 or 10 abstract artists in the state. and we put them in there. And in some way, hopefully that gives them a little resume boost, you know, helps them wherever they do happen to be selling their work, in whatever commercial venue they're selling their work, just by having, you know, some more exposure for their business. We do sell the work ourselves. We do have in the consignment gallery, we do a commission-based business with our artist members. The one advantage I think we do have with that sort of operation is that our part, our commission goes back to the artists. We are a not-for-profit.
You've got two great rooms with beautiful plate glass windows, wonderful Eastern light in your Carmel space. And you participate in the second Saturday gallery walks regularly, right?
Right.
Which has to be a terrific way to get more of the word out.
Yeah, the first one I went to was in March, and it was the first really pretty weekend that happened. And I was actually sort of surprised with the foot traffic. It was nice to see just people out enjoying the area and then taking advantage of the opportunities, because all the galleries are open. All the galleries are featuring, you know, new exhibitions, new work. And you do get a lot of people who happen to be out and come and enjoy and, you know, have a new experience. We, of course, you know, market those events to our memberships and to special invitation lists for the particular artists that we're showing. So
right.
We use them as opening receptions as well.
Can artists be represented by you as well as by other galleries then?
Yeah, certainly from our perspective, they can.
Okay.
And with most of the galleries around the state, that's usually not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly frequent between commercial galleries where there's a non-compete clause, but most see the Hoosier Salon as someone or as an entity that's not in a competitive position.
No, you're educational. And as
right.
you just say, commissions go right back into artist education
right.
and promotion.
Right.
How do you, because there's only one of you, how are you keeping an eye on what's going on with artists around the state? Are you just on the road a lot or how's that working?
I'm there, but I do have a gallery manager in New Harmony and a gallery manager in Carmel, and they take care of a lot of the operational components of keeping those places going, and a lot of interaction with the artists. We have a very successful program in the spring in New Harmony called First Brush of Spring, which is kind of the first opportunity in Indiana where you can get out and paint. And, you know, 200 artists from around the country come in for basically almost 2 weeks and work there. And our gallery manager there is very much involved with artist relations. My job is also doing that, trying to
sure.
meet people and lure new people into the mix. But I also have sort of the additional component of trying to get out to the patron side, to the collector side, to the funder side, and try to make sure that all of the entities who can be supporting the arts in Indiana are coming together.
That's where your background is tremendously helpful, I'm sure.
I think that's partially why I was hired.
Yeah.
I do bring my ties from the museum, the Indiana State Museum, to this job.
Are you an artist yourself?
I have a BFA in painting.
Uh-huh. Do you find time to paint? Do you make time to paint?
I paint very, very rarely, and it's partially because as a young man I decided or realized I wasn't motivated enough to be a studio artist. I think you have to be really, really driven to put yourself in a studio every day. So I went and got an art history degree and went into museums instead. But I still create stuff. I was a Creative Renewal recipient a few years ago, and it was a nice little push for me to start making stuff for myself. Most of the stuff I'm doing now is computer-based. So it's sort of painting with light instead of painting with oil.
Wow. Did you do some workshops as part of your Creative Renewal Fellowship? Or
I did a couple speaking engagements
yeah.
where I showed work and talked about the work.
Sharon Gamble with Hoosier Salon Executive Director Jim May. The salon's annual exhibition opens to the public at the Glick Indiana History Center on July 30th. It's on view there through September 26th. Then it makes a statewide tour. For more information about the annual exhibit and other Hoosier Salon events, check out HoosierSalon.org. Again, HoosierSalon.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. It may be a bit difficult to remember when local author John Green was just a star and not a superstar. Either way, not many authors get to be stars or superstars like Green has. In anticipation of the release of the movie Paper Towns this weekend, we'll replay an interview from our archives that Travis DiNicola did with Green before his books were being made into movies.
The Indiana Authors Award selected you as the national winner. I want to start out by just asking you what it means to you to be honored in this way.
Oh, it means a lot. I mean, it means a lot coming from my hometown. This place has really become home to my family and me. And so it's a tremendous honor. It's also an honor to be acknowledged alongside writers I really admire, like Barb and Dan. So, it's really a thrill.
Cool. Well, I know a lot of people were very excited when you moved back, and this is a great recognition of that. You have become your own brand, and a really both complex and interesting one, I find, as an author. I mean, when we had you for the opening of Indie Reads Books, there were 400 very well-behaved teenage girls there with their books in hand, which was kind of a really exciting thing to see. I mean, that many young people with physical books wanting to, celebrate literacy with you. And that's, I mean, you've got such a great appeal with young kids, but it goes beyond the books. It's, I mean, what you're doing online with your blogs, numerous websites. Do you feel a little, multi-personality with all your different brands?
Well, I mean,
schizophrenic,
I see it all as part of the same, same endeavor in a lot of ways, because I'm trying to talk about stuff that I find interesting with people I find interesting. And a lot of times that takes the form of novels, which for me is the place where I can have sort of in-depth conversations, both as a reader and a writer. That's a place where I can go to have quiet, contemplative time, kind of alone, or at least alone with one other person, the author. Mm-hmm. But it's also really important to me to reach out to the places where people are. Not just to the places where maybe I wish they would be, but the places where they are. And they are on Twitter, and they are on Tumblr, and they are on Facebook. And so that's important to me. And I think because I grew up with the internet, it's just always been a part of my life. And I don't see it as separate from my writing work, really. I see it as part of it.
Tell me about Nerd Fighters, because that's a big part of your online work that you're doing, and online personality.
Yeah, the community of people who watch the videos that my brother and I make are called Nerd Fighters, because they fight for nerd culture and intellectualism and just generally celebrate nerdiness. It's been a huge part of my life, and I have so much admiration for these young people who are excited and enthusiastic, because really, I mean, when we criticize people for being nerds, what we're actually saying is you are getting too excited about something. You are geeking out, as we say. I think it's great to geek out. I think it's great to be excited. I love to see passion. I mean, we're only, at least so far as we know, we're only here just the once. Like, are we going to spend that time reveling in ironic detachment, or are we going to spend that time marveling at the miracle of human consciousness? And Nerdfighters remind me every day that that it's a real privilege to be here, a real privilege to be able to observe the universe, and it is something that we should get excited about.
And passionate about, and enthusiastic about. And it doesn't have anything, even though, I mean, a lot of your reach is, through your books and through the work you do online with young adults, it's not limited to that at all.
No. In fact, most of the people who watch our videos are over 18.
Yeah.
And frankly, these days, most of the people who read my books are over 18, too. I mean, The Fault in Our Stars is read primarily by adults. In all of my work, I want to reach the broadest possible audience.
You mentioned your brother. You two do a lot of video work together. Were famous for the video communication that you had with each other over a couple years a year back. Tell me a bit about that, working with your brother on things like this.
Well, we started making videos back and forth to each other in 2007 when YouTube was still kind of a new thing. And we thought that we were only going to do it for a year. But our audience grew very large, and we felt a responsibility to the audience, I guess. And so we kept making videos. In fact, we just made
You were making videos in lieu of sending each other emails. And,
right, yeah. And, we'd given up all textual communication. And
which
we're
is a weird thing for an author to do.
Well, it is, but I also feel like text, particularly between friends or family members, can be a way of sort of insulating yourself from intimacy. And so I wanted to be seeing my brother and talking to him, because he lives in Montana and we don't see each other very often. So I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to have that feeling of close interaction again that I hadn't had since we were little kids. But yeah, I mean, obviously I do like text. I'm a fan of it, but so we did that for a year and then, and then that just sort of kept going, and we just made our 1,000th video, and I mean, we just passed 250 million video views. So, we've been, it's been six crazy years.
I was just watching a video that recently posted. The title, I think, it was roughly "Why Corporations Don't Have to Suck." Is that close?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, tell me a bit about this one.
Well, a few years ago, my brother started a record label for YouTube musicians to sort of restructure the deals that musicians traditionally get, so that they would basically, his company basically does the distribution, the artists themselves, who are already doing all their own promotion and marketing, get the vast majority of the sales from each album. And this has worked really well, but then they've also expanded into many other kinds of businesses. And the argument that I wanted to make in the video is that when you make a business that's focused on filling a need and making a reasonable profit, that the economy isn't a zero-sum game, that, like, you know, we can grow the entire size of the economy, and that's ultimately how jobs are created and things like that. So the idea, and we all have this idea that, like, while we like the things that corporations make, we find the corporations themselves a little bit icky. And there are some good reasons.
You reference iPods and Dr. Pepper.
Right, and, we like iPods and Dr. Pepper, but we don't necessarily like Apple or PepsiCo or I actually don't know who makes Dr. Pepper. It might be independent. But we don't, you know, I wanted to, you know, to argue that within this post-industrialization capitalism, there is, you know, there is within that some kinds of businesses to actually celebrate.
Do you ever, I mean, it's got to be an interesting balance that, and I don't know how intentional you are in maintaining it in terms of both. The fact that you're speaking out on things like this is exciting to your fans, but there's also always that risk of alienating some of your fans. I mean, I saw one time, I don't even remember what it was, but a couple of weeks ago you had posted something on Facebook that was somewhat political, and people were like, oh, John Green's being political. You know, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Wasn't that political. yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty... I can't not be myself.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel an obligation to be someone other than myself, and I also think that because I do espouse a kind of political centrism that's a bit out of fashion at the moment of our celebration of ideological rigidity, I do feel a bit of a responsibility to stand up as one of those voices of just, hey, let's meet in the middle. You know, the old-fashioned American idea of compromise. So I guess I do feel a responsibility to do that. But I also, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr, I am myself. And it doesn't really do me any good not to be myself.
Right, right. But in terms of that responsibility, I mean, does it cross your mind that, you know, as you said, I mean, you've got more perhaps readers now that are over 18, but so much of your fan base is, you know, teenage girls and boys, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, who are following you, who are reading this stuff. And, you know, some people could say, oh, is he influencing them in a positive manner? I mean, what sort of, I mean, responsibility do you feel towards that?
Well, I think it's a real privilege to have a seat at the table in the lives of young people when they're forming their values and when they're deciding what matters most to them, what's important to them. When they're grappling with these big, interesting philosophical questions of human existence for the first time, that's a real privilege, and it's one that I try to take very seriously, both in my novels and in my online work. At the same time, I try always to encourage people to disagree with me, mm-hmm. and not to assume that I'm right. And in fact, you know, I try to always say that I might be wrong and that I've been wrong before. And then, in fact, I'm often wrong, and that, like, it's okay to change your mind, and that it, you know, that value formation process is not a monolithic event. It's a process that goes on for your entire life, and it's okay to change and grow and
explore and
yeah
absolutely. And maybe make some mistakes along the way.
Absolutely,
almost certainly. Let's talk a bit about your work. I mean, your newest book, The Fault in Our Stars, has been a New York Times bestseller, has had amazing reviews. Congratulations.
Thanks.
On that. The book is set here in Indianapolis. Tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, it's about two kids, Hazel and Augustus, who meet at a support group for teenagers with cancer. And Hazel has stage 4 thyroid cancer and has been sick and terminally sick for quite a while. Augustus is in remission from a bone cancer. And they meet and they kind of share a love for a book that was written by an author who now lives in seclusion in Amsterdam. And they really want to meet this author and ask him what happens after the end of his book, which has a very sort of ambiguous, annoyingly ambiguous ending. And so it's really the story of their sort of emergent love together, and also their love of this book. But it is, it's set here in Indianapolis. So, like, from the Indianapolis Museum of Art to the Speedway at 86th and Ditch, there are lots of familiar places.
So you've been back in Indy now for, what, about 4 years or so?
5 years.
Five years. And what is it like being, you know, an author living here? I mean, I know you certainly travel for your work quite a bit, but this is home.
This is home, and I love this city, and I think it's a great city for an American writer to live in because it's such an American city, in both the best ways and the most challenging ways. You know, I think that the people here are uncommonly generous and hardworking, and I believe that ultimately a place is its people, and that's why I love Indianapolis, is because I love my friends here, and, you know, we've grown to have such great relationships with our friends and neighbors here, mm-hmm. and I can't imagine ever living anywhere else. But it also embodies America in the sense of chain restaurants. I mean, this is where if you want to start a new chain restaurant, this is your test market, because
it's
so American. It's so, and I think so. If I'm going to be writing about America, it feels very right to me to mm-hmm. be living here in a place that resembles in so many important ways, and that symbolizes in so many important ways. Both what I love and what I struggle with about contemporary America. So it's the perfect place for me, but I also just really like living here. I love biking around the city. I love driving my car. I'm an American in that sense. So, you know, it's great. I really love it here.
So can you share with us a bit about what you're working on now?
I'm not working on much at the moment. This book has sort of taken over my life, which is great. That's obviously a wonderful thing to have happen to you, but it makes it difficult to write. But I'm just starting to research a new book, parts of which are set here. So we'll see.
So, John, let me ask you one last question. For your fans out there that are listening right now, what book would you recommend to them to read while they're waiting for your next one?
Well, they're going to have to read a bunch. I just read a wonderful young adult novel that also is a great read for adults, called Every Day by David Levithan, which is about a person with no gender or body who wakes up each day in the body of a different person and spends one day inside that person's body, sort of possessing them, essentially. It's a really, really interesting novel. It's that rare novel that has a great premise that also pulls off the premise really interestingly. So, yeah, I'd recommend Every Day.
Very cool. John Green, it's great to have you on Art of the Matter. And again, congratulations for being the national winner of the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award this year. It's a great honor, and it's well-deserved.
Oh, thanks very much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with author John Green from an interview originally broadcast in 2012. The movie Paper Towns, based on Green's books, is in theaters this weekend. Hey, Travis.
Yeah, Sharon.
I'm going to tell you how long The Art of the Matter and John Green have been acquainted. You know this yourself.
It goes back quite a while,
actually. It goes back all the way back when we weren't archiving interviews. So if you're like, wait, didn't Sharon interview John about paper towns a million years ago?
Yeah,
but we weren't archiving our interviews back then. But he was as down to earth then as he is in the interview that you recorded recently and all the conversations.
And that was Paper Towns, before Fault in Our Stars came out.
Absolutely, yeah. Long before that. So just a nice, nice guy. Can't be happier for somebody becoming famous and a more world-renowned person. So, and we have some other authors and other things to tell you about on our calendar we call.
What do we do?
What do you got?
Well, you know what? There's a very cool fundraiser coming up in just about a week, July 31st at the Tarkington at the Center for the Performing Arts. It's a night at the bar, and it's the fundraiser for the Indiana Ballet Conservatory. And they are going to have lots of great cocktails at the bar and food
drink. Do we have to do a ballet workout at the BARRE after we go to the BAR?
The BAR to the BARRE. Exactly.
I want to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it should be very fun. So you can get more information at IndianaBalletConservatory.org. There'll be some great sort of behind-the-scenes events, and you get to see some great dancing, too.
I love it. Hey, speaking of fundraisers benefiting good causes, the Grassroots District Brew Fest, presented by The Warehouse and benefiting Hamilton-based organization Chaucy's Place, will happen on August 22nd. I'm giving you a little heads up early so you can grab your tickets. This is going to take place just behind the Indiana Design Center, which is one street west of Rangeline Road in the Carmel Arts and Design District. Very easy to find. It's a small town once you get up there. The inaugural event will boast up to 20 brewers featuring unique and craft brews, plus food vendors and live entertainment. And there's some different levels of tickets, including a VIP ticket and a general admission ticket, and you can find all of that by Googling District Brew Fest and either The Warehouse or Carmel, Indiana. And again, it benefits Chaucy's Place, which is a great cause. Coming
Very cool.
up August 22nd.
Well, next week on The Art of the Matter, I get to chat with Scotty from Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, who's playing out at Symphony on the Prairie. But this weekend for Marsh Symphony on the Prairie, it's the movie music of John Williams.
Ooh.
Dun, dun. That's right. They're going to have music from Jaws, as well as Star Wars, Harry Potter, Indiana Jones, E.T., lots of really fun ones. And on Friday night, it's Scout Night, so any scout in uniform under the age of 18 who brings a pasta donation for Second Helpings gets in free. So that should be a lot of fun. Lots of great
spaghetti.
Music. Yeah, music for John Williams, Symphony on the Prairie this weekend.
I think we're going to need a bigger boat for our calendar. Love, Loss, and What I Wore is it's such a charming show. It's the title kind of says it all. It's a show about women and how our clothes affect our personalities. And if you're a guy and about to tune out, don't, because I've been in audiences of performances of this and heard guys say it at the end of the show, oh, that explains so much about my sweetie. Lots and lots of humor, a little bit of poignant stuff, all about everything from when mom made the dress for the little girl for her first dance to scraps of clothing that belonged to a dear departed relative. Love, Loss, and What I Wore, starring five of Indy's most talented actresses on stage at Theater on the Square, but you better go soon because it's only playing through August 1st.
Very good. Hey, if you haven't been out to the zoo for animals and all that jazz yet this summer, then what are you waiting for? It continues on next Thursday night on the 30th with Appaladdin. It's a Latin and American folk combination type of music with a Night of Havana themed food stations. The music goes from 5:30 to 8:30 on Thursday nights, and the animals are up on exhibit till 7 p.m. They may be up afterwards, but you can't see them. And
the parrots are back there doing the rumba.
I'd like to see that. And then the following week, August 6th, Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra, great big band that's going to be playing at Animals and All That Jazz at the Zoo Thursday nights.
We know them, and you listeners know their music. That's our theme music. Mm-hmm. Hey, around this time of year, especially if you've got younger people in your life getting ready to go back to school, you're looking around going, "Ack, I need more storage space." So you might be culling your bookshelves. If you're wondering what to do with all of your old books that are piling up around the house, well, you know, Indy Reads Books has always been a great place to donate those books. But in particular, they are partnering with the Indianapolis Museum of Art right now as part of a community book drive to gather reading materials for a large-scale hanging book installation, which is going to debut at the museum this fall. The installation is called False Ceiling Indianapolis. The sculptor is a British guy called Richard Wentworth. You've probably heard of him. And it'll be on display in the Ephraimson Family Entrance Pavilion beginning September 25th. You can bring both hardback and paperback books. No magazines or books with damp pages or bugs will be accepted. That seems reasonable to me. All books must be dropped off at the collection box at the IMA or at Indy Reads Books on Mass Ave. You can drop those off through September 8th, so go clean your bookshelves.
That's going to be a really cool exhibit, too, the Wentworth
wait.
Exhibit
That's
at the IMA.
Brilliant.
Hey, last thing real quick, poets out in Lawrence. They have a poetry reading at the Lawrence Arts Center on the east side, and the next one's coming. They do this once a month, and it's from 6:30 to 8:30. The next one's on July 28th. Catherine Swanson, who's reading from her new chapbook, A Map in the Wind, and she's an ethnographer and refugee advocate and works in Indianapolis, and it should be a very interesting evening.
All right, go see Paper Towns this weekend, and remember you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And join us next week because we'll be back with more things you can see, do, hear, enjoy, dance, drink, on. What'll we do? On that calendar
recall,
what do we do?
Thanks, Sharon.
Sorry.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
For writer and culture chronicler Tamara Winfrey Harris, the stereotypes we force on black women can be just as limiting as actual shackles. Her first book is The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative for Black Women in America. And Sharon Gamble invited Tamara in to learn what inspired her to write the book. Tamara began by reading a passage.
I asked several women why, despite tremendous pressure to feel differently, they are happy being black women. I asked them how they achieve all rightness. I'm all right, says Heather Carper, because I understand human nature. For so many people to have spent so much time, effort, and expense to denigrate, defile, and destroy us, I know that my black femaleness must be fearfully and wonderfully made, as the old church folks say. It cannot be bought, it cannot be imitated, and it cannot be destroyed. Deisha says, the racist and the sexist have failed miserably in trying to convince me that I don't matter, that I am less than. I spent the first 35 years of my life feeling that way, and not even because of racism or sexism. I decided that I didn't have any more time to waste living in fear of what other people thought of me, which really isn't living at all. Defining myself for myself and not giving that personal power away is what makes me all right. Not needing a racist or sexist person's permission for anything is what makes me all right. Not needing anyone to like me or approve of my politics or my aesthetic is what makes me all right. I have to be all right because I need my daughters to know that they are all right. Jamila Banu says, I am completely happy with my identity, and it has never occurred to me not to be. I am in love with my black woman self. I am in love with black womanhood. I exult in how many ways there are for us to be uniquely beautiful, the shapes and shades in which we walk in the world. I love our laughter and fierceness and care and energy and exhaustion and brilliance and creativity. That perceptions other than this exist is honestly puzzling to me. In a nod to literary great Zora Neale Hurston, Jamila adds, how could anyone deny themselves the pleasure of my company? It is beyond me. Ebony Murphy Root also quotes Zora, I love myself when I am laughing and then again when I am looking mean and impressive. It is not surprising to hear black women dropping wisdom from a famous foremother. From our earliest years, Black women draw strength and inspiration from our heritage and the women who came before us. We learn from them how to be okay, even when the world seems mad. A 2014 study of Black girls in New York City revealed that girls who were strongly in touch with their racial heritage were more likely to be happy and committed to their schoolwork, to getting good grades, and to aspire to higher education. In addition, these girls were more likely to believe that they would ultimately achieve their goals and to have healthy relationships. Evidence also suggests that positive messages and support from parents and other important adults, as well as peers, can support the development of positive race and gender identities and mitigate some of the effects of racism. Immersing ourselves and future generations in the strength of our past creates a foundation for Black girls and women to do more than just survive. We thrive. "I know the shoulders on which I stand," explains Jamila, acknowledging personal mentors, teachers, sisters, friends, and the examples of women through history whose giant steps paved the way for us all. Fatima Thomas believes that although Black women are not unbreakable, we are, even at our lowest points, survivors. "It's the small things for me that add up to who I am. Something as simple as getting out of bed when I'd rather ball up and cry for days, the fact that I can do that, the fact that, which with much less than I have, women who came before me and have this skin in common with me just kept getting up. The strong Black woman trope is a double-edged sword. As much as I want to just be, I actually am far stronger than most. I love that about us. We are all right because we recognize our worth as individuals and appreciate the knowledge that brought us into that space," Deborah Latham White adds. "Our strength lies in the Black woman collective, past but also present." Jamila encourages Black women to seek empowering relationships with other women and to make conscious decisions to support and nurture one another. "We can change our personal narratives. I mean that in the way in which we tell our stories about ourselves, and to each other, the things we expect for ourselves, and that kind of stuff. While everyone whispers about our wrong, we can nod knowingly to each other and celebrate our right." What is wrong with Black women? Simple answer, not a damn thing. We're not perfect, but we're no more flawed than anyone else. In fact, most Black women believe it's pretty good to be us. We are not Jezebels or mammies or matriarchs or sapphires, or not just. Some of us are workhorses, and some of us are angry, and some of us are promiscuous. We are all and none of these things. Black women are human, with all the complexity that implies. We have facets like diamonds. The trouble is the people who refuse to see us sparkling.
So this book is a beautiful bomb thrown in the middle of the narrative to blow it up. How did you first realize that you wanted to write this book in an attempt to change the narrative?
Well, you know, it all started, my initial idea was to write a book about Black women in marriage, because a few years ago, there was this huge discussion about why Black women tend to marry less than our white counterparts. And the response to that was extremely sexist and racist. It was, as often is the case when we talk about single women, centered on what must these women be doing wrong that no one is choosing them. So I started researching that issue and talking to women. But as I dug further into it, the reality is a lot of the biases that were beneath that discussion actually affect Black women in a lot of other ways. You know, how we feel about our beauty, our health, our strength, marriage,
sexuality.
Then it became sort of a larger story. Marriage is a part of it, but it's a larger story about Black women and how we need to remake how people think about us.
There are some stereotypes that you've outlined, and you reference them in the closing passage of the book. Can we talk about those for a moment?
Sure. So the four core stereotypes that Black women encounter are the mammy, the sapphire, the Jezebel, and the matriarch. The Mammy, you know, from if you've ever seen Gone with the Wind, the classic film, is sort of an asexual black woman who loves to serve. And a lot of black women said they encounter the expectation that they will be mammy-like in people's expectations of them. It is, you know, your church expecting you to work tirelessly, your family expecting you to work tirelessly, and to work to carry multiple burdens on your own, not because you have to, but because it's what you were born to do. And then we have the Sapphire, who is the angry black woman, and we see that one come up. As a matter of fact, last year, the New York Times wrote an article about How to Get Away with Murder. It's a hit show, showrunner Shonda Rhimes. And the very first line says that if Shonda were going to write her autobiography, the first line would be How to Get Away with Being an Angry Black Woman. And we all know Michelle Obama has been accused of being angry almost since she appeared on the national stage. And then you have the hypersexual Jezebel, and you can see that in the ways that people react to people like Beyonce and whether or not they think her sexuality is okay. And then you have the matriarch that emerged kind of in the mid-20th century, very much as a result of the Moynihan Report that identified that the biggest problem facing black America, and think of this, the Civil Rights Act is barely signed. The biggest problem facing black America is that black women are stepping up to lead their households. And so the narrative of the single black mother and the absent black father and the, you know, fatherless children has followed us throughout the, you know, welfare queen 80s and beyond.
I think if you look up the word disconnect, that would be an example. Mm-hmm. What spurred the Moynihan Report for people who aren't familiar?
You know, I don't know what was behind that, but it was a government report looking at the inequities in, you know, how black families were faring in the mid-60s and why there was poverty and crime and problems like that. And it did, to be fair, it did talk about some of the systemic inequities that black families faced, but it still pointed to the major problem being that women were heading too many households.
It's just there aren't words for how astonishing that is.
Yeah.
You know what? and double standards. I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, you have an interesting exploration of mm-hmm. So there's Madonna
mm-hmm.
and there's Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
And why do we view them so differently? Because they've both done different things to advance their career and to exploit their sexuality and mm-hmm. as they grow up, as mm-hmm. they age mm-hmm. and become adults.
So you have Madonna, and I think almost everybody recognizes her as a feminist hero. Like, we remember her and her bullet bras and mm-hmm. crotch grabbing and her 1992 book about sex. And we see her as a trailblazer. And she came out and she said, you know, sexuality isn't just for men. I can enjoy my body. I can enjoy sexuality, which is a very feminist statement. But then you have Beyonce, who is also very sexual, and she's actually stood on stage and said, I am a feminist, and included it in her songs. But that sexuality is seen sort of just for titillation. And I think there are two things behind that. And one has to do with race and one doesn't. I think fundamentally, Beyonce fits within what we think of as standard beauty. She is the kind of woman that we imagine men would like to gaze upon. So it's harder to believe that when she is being beautiful and sexual, that it's just for her or that she's doing it for women. We think it must be for men because why would they not love Beyonce? I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, I think, is the different ways that we look at white sexuality and black sexuality. So the thoughtful, restrained sexuality of white people and the more animalistic, thoughtless view of black sexuality.
Who should read this book?
Everybody. Well, I would say my primary target is black women because mm-hmm. I wanted to have it feel like a discussion. We were sitting down and talking and telling each other, you are okay. And these experiences that you're having, you're not alone. I wanted us to have a chance to hear our voices because we so rarely do hear them in mainstream media. But I think other women, I mean, I always say that sexism affects us all as women, it just affects us a little differently depending on our intersections, our race and our class and our ability and our sexuality. So I think there are a lot of things that other women who are not Black women will relate to. And, of course, men ought to read it, too.
I was going to say it. And sexism affects men as well.
It sure does.
The boys we raise, I had an interesting conversation with a male friend the other day who was not aware that women were still not paid the same as men for the same job. I'm like, how do you not know that?
Right. And the limits that people place on what femininity is, they're also placing limits on what masculinity is. And that doesn't allow men to be free and whole people either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whatever the race or sexual orientation, there's we're all struggling.
Right.
Have you considered developing some kind of a course based around this book or a workshop?
Well, I think actually I hope to do. I have a few workshops and presentations. And if your listeners visit my website, TamaraWinfreyHarris.com, I am so excited to be able to go and talk to groups of women and men, to students, and to come and talk more and discuss the issues in this in the book.
Sharon Gamble with writer Tamara Winfrey Harris. Her just-published first book is The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative for Black Women in America. You can meet Tamara this Saturday at noon at Indie Reads Books at 911 Mass Ave and learn more about Tamara, who also is Vice President of Communications and Marketing for the Idle Jorg Museum, at TamaraWinfreyHarris.com. Again, TamaraWinfreyHarris.com. And you can find her book at Amazon.com and your favorite bookstore. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll get a preview of this year's Indiana State Fair.
And I'll chat with Scotty Morris, the lead singer of Big Bad Voodoo Daddy.
And I'll find out about a new interactive history exercise or game called Looking Up College Avenue. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.